Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. 24 hours ago, the streets of the Kenyan capital were full of protesters, furious about the government's plans to raise taxes to help pay the interest on the country's vast public and foreign debt. Some of the crowd stormed Parliament, forcing MPs to flee. Part of the complex was set on fire. President William Ruto said violence and anarchy would not be tolerated, and he deployed the army. At least 22 people were killed in the clashes. He also said he would press ahead with signing the controversial finance bill into law. Well, fast forward to today, and that determination seems to have crumbled in dramatic fashion. A few hours ago, Mr. Ruto appeared on TV to announce that the bill was being abandoned.
Listening keenly to the people of Kenya, who have said loudly that they want nothing to do with this Finance Bill 2024, I concede, and therefore I will not sign the 2024 Finance Bill, and it shall subsequently be withdrawn.
So why the change of heart? Barbara Plett-Usher is our correspondent in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Well, what he said was that basically the people weren't behind him. He said, I lead a government, but I also lead a people, and the people have spoken. So, but the people have been speaking for a little while already. You'd had public consultations with various opposition expressed, also from business, actually, for various parts of the tax bill. And then these massive protests that sort of came out of the blue as far as the government was concerned and carried on last week and then into this week. So, and he'd stayed firm throughout that period, and now he changed. So it seems that the violence on Tuesday must have been a factor because, you know, police killed more than 20 people at that time and injured many more. And I think that really shook the country. Social and religious organizations here spoke out against it, and international partners of Kenya also basically condemned the violence and called for restraint. So I think he probably, that really added a whole other level of pressure on him to deal with the finance bill. And whatever the case, he has now said he won't sign it and that it will be withdrawn.
So what happens now in terms of the government's efforts to try to raise more revenue, which it desperately needs to do, doesn't it?
It does. And in fact, Mr. Ruto gave out quite a clear rationale for that before he conceded defeat. He said that this was very necessary to reduce the national debt, and that this money to be raised by taxes was also supposed to go for development programs involving, you know, farmers and students and teachers, among others. He did not say where the money would come from now, although he did say that basically he said there would be a cost, that there would have to be discussions at local government level and involving other people about how to implement certain austerity measures and to tighten belts. But he said his main approach was to organize a consultation, or like a national dialogue. This is going to involve the young people, but also different parts of society. He didn't say what the framework for that would be, but he said that they needed to go forward together so that the people were behind whatever changes were made.
And what about the violence? I mean, is there going to be any sort of investigation into how things got so out of hand?
That is not something that he said or that the government has said. It is something that the protesters have begun to call for, or the activists have begun to call for. And despite this climb down by Mr. Rucho, some prominent activists have already sort of dismissed the move as a PR gesture, saying that Mr. Rucho maybe had another agenda, basically not trusting him, and saying that the people would still be coming out onto the streets on Thursday when the next demonstration was planned. And I think calling for an investigation will probably be part of any demonstration we see in the next little while.
That was the BBC's Barbara Plettusher in Nairobi. Well, let's get some reaction to President Ruto's climb down. Chris is 26. He joined the protests in Nairobi yesterday and spent several hours out on the streets. What does he make of the government's U-turn?
For me, I think it's a sigh of relief. It feels good to finally win one, at least for us as the youth. I mean, seeing him back down and actually concede to our very specific demands, yeah, it's a sigh of relief, I think.
And when you say that it's a win for the youth, is it that young people feel they're not listened to in Kenya?
It's not a lie. I mean, the facts speak for themselves. Like, the last election, 8 million people didn't vote, majority of whom were youth. Very many of the people I know, friends of mine, did not vote. So we've been feeling alienated for a while. There's been a sort of like detachment between the political class and the youth. And for once, I think this particular time, it just came into like one big bubble. You know, it was just like, enough is enough. Like, these guys need to hear us. And especially when you consider that many of the things in the finance bill are actually going to affect the youth more than anyone.
Yeah, so, I wanted to ask you, what would it have meant for you if the bill had been signed into law and had gone through?
I mean, yeah, just a few estimates looking at your payslip for sure. Your take-home salary would have reduced significantly. But most importantly, it's that the things we were being taxed for just didn't make sense. It just felt like we're throwing money down a pit, because a lot of this income that he was going to collect from our taxes is going to go to pay a debt which we were not really consulted in taking.
And that is the problem, that Kenya still has those huge public debts and foreign debts too. I mean, do you accept the need to try to pay down those debts? I mean, the country can't keep borrowing forever, can it?
No, it can't. I mean, like, for sure there is a big problem with the public debt. And those are now the questions I think for us youth, we're really trying to hold our leaders accountable to. One of the key, I'd say, themes of the protest was the fact that 2 years in, so much money has been borrowed, but we can't really point out any tangible, like, development projects that this government has done. That's a huge problem.
What was your experience of the protests yesterday? I mean, from the outside, they seemed, you know, extraordinarily dramatic and in places violent.
I was in the streets myself, and I mean, it was two very different pictures. So for me, who was on the street, it was largely peaceful. Me and a bunch of my friends, all of us turned up. And it was largely peaceful. You know, we're just in the streets chanting and whistling and, you know, just singing songs. But the guys at home who were watching stuff on the news were like, oh my gosh, you know, it's terrible. Guys are getting shot and all that. And I was just like, I don't see it happening. So for me personally, my experience was there was police near us. They didn't seem to be bothered, so long as, like, you know, no one was actually doing anything. You know, shops that were on the street were open. Guys were going in, buying water, you know, so it was largely peaceful. There was no chaos, there was no violence actually at all, you know. So I do have my suspicions that maybe there were a few...
Who do you think it might have been?
Well, I mean, there's only one person who benefits from these protests looking violent. I'd probably say my bet would have been it's on the government.
To discredit the protesters?
Yeah, because for sure I can assure you, at least from my experience, there was no violent protesting yesterday.
Just one final question. I mean, do you think the government will try and get another similar bill through at some point in the future? And if so, what do you think people will do?
I don't think so. The biggest benefit that's come from this is that I'd say the youth are finally politically awake, you know, which we haven't been for a very long time. You know, like, most of the politics were just like, yeah, we leave that to our parents to kind of like figure out which way we're going to vote. But for once, I mean, like, the youth are actually politically awake. Before this finance bill, I'll be honest, I mean, I never really bothered to to follow and see what was being passed by Parliament, you know. But now I can assure you for a fact, the next finance bill that comes through, every single Kenyan is going to read that thing, literally comb through it. So I don't think they're going to be able to get away with the ignorance and apathy that has helped them do the things they've been able to do in the past. More than ever, I think our leaders now know that what we the people think matters.
Chris, one of the protesters in Kenya. This US election cycle has so far been devoid of any major shocks, given that a Joe Biden-Donald Trump rematch was seen as inevitable. But the great unknown is who Donald Trump will pick as his running mate. So who might it be? What's driving the choice? The BBC's Nader Taufik has been taking a look at some of the rumoured leading contenders.
We need Donald Trump!
Donald J. Trump will make America great again.
Thank you. In what feels like the VP edition of The Apprentice, there's no shortage of contenders vying to be Donald Trump's running mate. Among the reported shortlist, a governor from the fourth least populous state of North Dakota, a black Southern Republican senator, a Cuban American senator from Florida, a Trump Country so-called intellectual populist, and a millennial congresswoman from New York.
Given his penchant for drama, I think his preference really is to keep people guessing.
Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota believes it's highly likely Trump will pick the governor of his state, Doug Burgum.
Who are we going to send back to the White House? Trump!
Like Trump, he entered politics in 2016 as a businessman. The wealthy governor made his fortune by mortgaging his family's farm to invest in a software company, which he later took public and sold to Microsoft for $1.1 billion in 2001.
He brings a stability, brings a knowledge of how to run a corporation, how to run a family farm, how to run a grain elevator. And I do think Doug's governing of the energy boom in North Dakota is very appealing to Donald Trump and to his message. And I do think that Doug Burgum balances some of the more impulse, if you will, and the big personality of Donald Trump.
So get ready for something, okay? Just get ready. But Doug Burgum has been incredible.
Myra Adams, a former Republican and an op-ed writer for the U.S. political website The Hill, also believes Burgum is the favorite to take it. Despite running in the Republican presidential primary, Governor Burgum doesn't have much of a national profile. She is betting that Trump wants someone photogenic who will staunchly defend him, but who will not outshine him.
Talk about a nothing burger. My little town has more people than North Dakota, but he doesn't present any kind of problem. He would just be a vanilla, just a vanilla old rich guy.
If Trump is more focused on a VP who could bring in additional votes, Myra is among those who say Senator Marco Rubio of Florida is the better choice.
He speaks Spanish. And that is so key. I can't emphasize that enough. This will be the first election where the Hispanic vote is projected to be larger than the black vote. Biden won 67% of Hispanic Catholics compared to 32% for Trump. Rubio could really help with Hispanic Catholics. Plus, Rubio is very experienced. He's vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee. But I don't think Trump trusts him. I think Trump believes that Rubio is just looking to be president.
Considered up with Burgum and Rubio in the top three is the new Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
Let's rebuild prosperity for America's citizens and reelect Donald J. Trump.
He once wondered whether Trump was America's Hitler, but is now close to Trump's son, Don Jr. He is seen by some as more useful in Congress and unlikely to add much to the ticket. Whoever it is would not only be a heartbeat away from the presidency should Trump win, but potentially the future leader of the party for years to come.
The BBC's Nader Taufik reporting there. You're listening to NewsHour. Still to come on the programme.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff of Starliner and Atlas V, carrying two American heroes, drawing a line to the stars for all of us.
That was the takeoff of the first crewed mission for Boeing's Starliner spacecraft 3 weeks ago for a mission that was due to last 8 days. They're still up there. So what went wrong? We'll try to answer that in about 20 minutes. We will also be trying to find out what's going on in Bolivia at the moment. The president of the country has denounced an unauthorized gathering of troops and tanks outside government buildings in the capital, La Paz. We'll be hoping to give you more details on that a little later in the program. Do stay with us. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, you'll know MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. We talk to them often about their brave work treating people in war zones. But there's another bit of the organisation that's less well known. It's called the MSF Access Campaign, and it was greatly expanded with money from MSF's Nobel Peace Prize win back in 1999. It is a small team of about 35 doctors and lawyers whose job it is to try to persuade or to force drug companies to lower their prices. And as we'll hear, it's been successful. But MSF says it's shutting it down and letting the team go. And that's prompted more than 100 other organisations and hundreds of global health experts to write an open letter calling on MSF to reverse its decision. Among them, Ellen Hatoon, who was Director of Policy Advocacy with the Access Campaign until 2008. She's been telling me more about its work.
They have focused number of priority areas. The best known is HIV/AIDS drugs. When the campaign was set up about 25 years ago, these drugs cost between $10,000 and $20,000 per patient per year. They were not available in most of the developing world. And the campaign managed to bring that cost down to $66 per patient per year. Today, that is the cost. That story isn't finished because new HIV medicines continue to come to market, and the newer medicines are again costly. They also worked on bringing the price down of hepatitis C treatments, of diabetes treatments, of the treatment for multidrug resistant tuberculosis. That is a recent achievement whereby they brought the price down from $289 to $130. Saving not only individuals, but also institutions such as the Global Fund, millions of dollars. It's not only the work on the direct price reductions, it is also the work the campaign has been doing on changing the rules of the game, the rules related to intellectual property, patents that rule these medicines, regulations to ensure that medicines are of assured quality, transparency of pricing. And again, all of that has benefited the world at large, not just the MSF operations.
So do you understand why MSF has decided to close this?
No. And I'm not the only one. There hasn't been a formal response to the letter. MSF has said that changes are necessary. No one is against changes, but there is not a clear alternative. It's not only the work that they do, it's also the expertise, the analysis, the studies, the research that they share with others. It's a generous institution.
In one response, MSF said that it wasn't reducing or halting its work on access to healthcare products, but said that instead it was redoubling those efforts.
That is not at all visible. There is no clear structure. There is no new strategy. And the people that are currently working for the campaign have been told that their contracts are going to be ended. I do see a greater emphasis on products that MSF needs directly in its own projects. And that can be a very laudable objective, but that is not an access campaign as we know it.
I mean, is it also about the huge financial pressures that an organization like MSF must be under, given everything that's going on in the world at the moment, wars in Ukraine, Gaza, Sudan, to name just a few? Could it be that they have decided that their immediate humanitarian work on the ground, in the field, is more important?
If this decision is based on financial considerations, and I do not believe that is the case, but let's assume it is, then it would be very short-sighted to close down the one entity that has actually brought tremendous savings, including for MSF.
But presumably there are other organizations that will take up that mantle or are campaigning for the same things anyway.
Well, what most organizations have actually voiced in the last few days is a concern of the weakening of their own ability to be effective without the MSF campaign as a partner. Most groups that are working on access issues that work with MSF do it on shoestring budgets. They do not have the kind of resources and they do not have access to the kind of data and on-the-ground experience that MSF has.
Ellen, is it too late to stop this, do you think?
I hope not. The groundswell of concern is enormous, and I frankly do not see how MSF can ignore the hundreds of people and organizations that have asked them to rethink this.
Ellen Hatoum. Now, Glastonbury opened its gates to festival goers this morning. It began on Worthy Farm, a working dairy farm, all the way back in 1970. And it's grown and grown ever since then to become the biggest event of its kind in the world. As well as the headline acts this year, such as Dua Lipa, Coldplay and SZA, there's also the Legend set on Sunday, which is given over to a seasoned star and often someone who's never played Glastonbury. This year, it's Shania Twain. She's been talking to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Let's go, girls.
Long before Taylor Swift, there was another female country singer who incorporated a pop sound into their music and became a phenomenon. Shania Twain's late 90s album, Come On Over, is one of the top 10 global bestsellers of all time. And this weekend, she follows the likes of Lionel Richie, Dolly Parton and Kylie Minogue by playing Glastonbury's Sunday Tea Time Legend slot.
I've been told that that is the slot.
You know Lionel Richie, don't you?
I know
you?
Lionel Richie.
Now, he had one of the best days of his life doing it.
So he's the one I should ask. It's surreal to have been invited. I'm a little overwhelmed. I mean, from the minute it was even a possibility, I had to keep it a secret. Then it's just been a flurry of everyone sharing all of their fabulous stories and how exciting it's going to be and bring my wellies, and now I'm thinking about which wellies should I bring. I've got several pairs at home. Should I buy new ones?
Have you got rhinestone on your wellies?
I don't. Should I get some with rhinestones?
Okay, so you're Brad Pitt.
That don't impress me much.
People who come to watch the Legends, a lot of them will wear fancy dress off the act. So let's go through some of the iconic Shania looks. That don't impress me much. How would you come dressed as in that video, would you say?
Anything in leopard print. Any color of leopard print. Pink, blue, green. That one's easy.
Man, I feel like a woman. Veil and top hat in the sun, is that going to work?
A top hat would work.
Yeah.
Why not? And why not a top hat that, like, pops up so that it doesn't take up any space when you're not wearing it?
Man, I feel like a woman.
Pick one more. One more Shania outfit you'd like to see there in the crowd.
Denim on denim. That works. That's the Any Man of Mine video, denim on denim.
Any man of mine, better walk the line.
A lot of people go into Glastonbury. It's the only time all year they put up their tent. What's your best putting up a tent tip?
You know what? I believe in pop-up tents. Don't be a hero.
Don't fight, don't argue.
And bring lots of extra socks.
Give me the chance to say that I'm sorry.
And Glastonbury is on a farm. I believe you can talk to animals. Explain about this.
I love horses. Mm-hmm. I love all animals. But I'm going to go see if there's a horse around I can borrow.
Would you bring a horse onto the stage?
If it's allowed, I'll do it. I'd love to ride a horse to the stage.
We're still together, still going strong. You're still the one I run to.
And finally, what kind of show are you going to deliver in the Legend slot?
I'd love to be able to sing with everyone and be a part of the journey of the crowd. So I'm going to do everything familiar. I want to do the hits. I want to do what they know.
Oh, you're still the one I kiss.
That was Shania Twain talking there to our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson about her forthcoming appearance at Glastonbury. You're listening to NewsHour. Still lots more to come in the second half of the programme.
Oh.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
A story now of triumph over adversity. The astonishing success of Afghanistan's men's cricket team, who've made it through to the semi-finals of the T20 World Cup, which has been co-hosted this year by the West Indies and the United States. It was on the island of St. Vincent in the Caribbean on Tuesday night that Afghanistan beat Bangladesh to go through to the last four, the first time they've reached the semi-finals of a major tournament. And it was a dramatic victory by just 8 runs, prompting celebrations on the streets of Kabul. Afghanistan will now face South Africa later today. England are playing India in the other semi-final. Well, I've been talking to the former Afghan cricketer Rais Ahmadzai. He retired in 2010 and now coaches the country's under-19 team. I asked him what it's been like watching the team's progress.
You know, it was a special day for the cricket, not only for the cricket fans. It's something very special for the whole nation. The way we start and now we reach the semi-final, it's something very special. It's something very amazing and something very nice for the people, you know, the way they celebrate here in the country. So that means a lot for our cricketers or for the whole nation.
Yes, you're in the capital, Kabul. I mean, what have the celebrations been like in the city?
You know, the best thing was everyone was busy, you know, all the shopkeeper, every person, you know, the taxi drivers, everyone was just watch the match. And it was just like 3.5 hours just for cricket in that time. In some area, it was 1,000 people came out to the streets.
How hard is it, though, playing cricket in Afghanistan at the moment, given the security situation? How is it? I mean, I know you're the under-19s coach. How hard is it getting grassroots cricket going in Afghanistan at the moment?
Everywhere, the young kids, they are playing cricket and they are so good in that. So we have that advantage that we have a natural talent and the way our national team is doing. So they are the role model now.
And can I ask, I know this is sensitive, but can I ask you this? I mean, does cricket and the professional game, does it have the support of the Taliban? I mean, do they encourage the development of the game in the country?
We are representing the country. We are not looking at who is in charge in the country. We're representing the country. We represent the nation. So sports is totally different. And we want to play for Afghanistan, not for any political party.
I understand. But of course, women can't play cricket, can they, at the moment?
It's not the right time to say about that. You know, we have still one issue about the education. That's very important. The girls' education is very important for us. Once that problem is solved, I think sports will be also allowed in the future.
How far can this team go? Do you think they can get through to the final and perhaps even win it? Is that possible?
Definitely. We beat the world champion, Australia. We beat New Zealand. And this is the best opportunity. We never beat South Africa in any format. But semi-final is the best opportunity for us to beat them. And then we can play a final against maybe England or maybe India.
And that was the former Afghan cricketer Rais Ahmadzai speaking to me from Kabul. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. And just to say, we are following events in Bolivia. There appears to be a military coup underway. President Luis Arce is due to speak, we think, according to some of the news agencies, in a few minutes. He's already denounced irregular mobilization by units of the Bolivian army. And there are pictures on social media of tanks on the streets of the capital, La Paz. We'll be getting some more details in the coming minutes. But we're going to head to Washington now, because the U.S. Supreme Court has confirmed the accidental posting of a ruling on a major abortion rights case. The ruling was briefly uploaded to the court's website and then removed. So what does it say? Nomia Iqbal is our North America correspondent.
Yes, so this ruling is in regards to this case, which essentially asks the question, can women, pregnant women, get an emergency abortion in Idaho? It's a state that has a near total abortion ban. But President Biden's administration, and this is Idaho versus Mr. Biden's administration, says Idaho state law is breaching a federal law. This federal law is called EMTALA. It stands for Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And it mandates every hospital that takes Medicaid is this federal and state funding to cover medical costs, to carry out an emergency abortion if a woman comes in and she needs that. And they're saying, the administration, that Idaho state law is breaching that federal law by not providing abortion care in certain cases where it is medically necessary. And so that's the case. And it appears from the draft that was uploaded, I've had a look at it, that the Supreme Court in its majority has sided with President Biden's administration in allowing emergency room abortions. But I should stress, it's just a draft at the moment. The Supreme Court would say, well, there's a reason why we've not published it yet, because it's not final.
When is the final decision due?
Well, this is what we're all waiting for. There are some big decisions yet to be made by the Supreme Court also, which includes former President Donald Trump asking for total immunity. This is one of the cases. It should be resolved by the end of the week. That's when the term finishes. But the Supreme Court could also move the cases into next week. But we should get a final ruling on this at some point in the next 2 weeks.
Is there any suggestion at all that it may have been deliberate, the fact that this was posted early? Because we did have that case, didn't we, with the ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade, of course, that the major federal abortion rights ruling back in May 2022, and then a draft opinion was released early, wasn't it?
That's right. And, you know, that was a big moment because everyone was prepared for it. And this time, it's I'm not quite sure, to be honest, because the Supreme Court has confirmed to us that it inadvertently posted this document online relating to this abortion case. The Supreme Court is so careful with things like this. They have this sort of run a tight ship. And when the Roe v. Wade draft was leaked, there was a massive investigation into it. But they're not using the word leaked. They're saying, look, we inadvertently posted it. It was, you know, a mistake. And the final ruling will come at some point. But I'm sure there'll be conspiracy theories and so forth out there about it. But as far as the Supreme Court goes, it was an accident.
That was Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Now, after all its recent problems with its planes, Boeing must have been hoping that its forays into space would pass off without incident.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition. And liftoff of Starliner and Atlas V, carrying two American heroes, drawing a line to the stars for all of us.
That was the launch of the company's Starliner spacecraft on June the 5th for its first crewed mission. On board, two American astronauts heading for the International Space Station, Sunita Sunny Williams and Barry Butch Wilmore. The mission was meant to last 8 days. Well, 3 weeks later, they're still up there and it's not clear when they're going to come home. A return flight was due to take place today, but it's been put back again until some point next month. It's all because of technical problems with the capsule, a helium leak, which was known about before the launch, that's now spread. And I should say that the two astronauts aren't in any danger, but it's not great for Boeing. The program was already a year behind schedule and the crew are stuck in orbit. So, what's it like when you're in space and things don't go as planned? A question for former NASA astronaut Susan Kilray.
I can talk directly with this because my first mission was cut short. My first space shuttle mission was cut short because of a failure. And there's a lot that goes on in your head about the failure, the time it takes. You have to troubleshoot it. You have to do the procedures. And we ended up having to come home early, which meant a whole bunch of other procedures. But you don't really have time to think about the extra risk involved. And Sonny and Butch, they're both Navy test pilots, as was I, and they're very experienced. This is a test flight of a vehicle. In fact, they actually had to take over and fly manually a little bit as they were docking because of some of the thruster failures. And that's a huge data point for NASA and for Boeing, that that all worked out as planned.
How serious was the failure that you experienced? I mean, could it have been potentially very dangerous for you?
It was potentially very dangerous. The signature they got indicated that if we didn't shut one of our electrical systems down, then it would have resulted in a fire. But we had two other systems, so we were safe. We had limited electricity, but had we lost another one, that's when it becomes very dangerous. As it all turned out, once they got back, we got back on the ground and they analyzed it, it was a sensor failure. And so there really was never any danger.
And what happened with Starliner? What has happened with Starliner?
Starliner has had small helium leak from the get-go. In fact, they launched with one. So that was a known issue that they're still trying to troubleshoot. And the helium is used to pressurize the propellant for their thrusters. And so they're still trying to figure out why the leak is there and how to fix it. But it's not of great concern. The thrusters, many of the thrusters failed. I can't remember exactly how many, five or six or whatever, when they were in the docking phase, which meant they had to take over and fly manually while some of the thrusters were repaired, brought back online by the computers, and then they could continue the approach to the station and the docking. That's of a more serious concern, especially in close proximity to the space station.
And if your return to Earth is delayed, I mean, what does that feel like? Is it just like, great, we've got some more time in space, this is wonderful? Or is it that feeling you get sometimes, and I'm not really comparing it, but, you know, if your flight is delayed from holiday, there is that sort of frustration, there's the uncertainty of not knowing when you're going to get back, and everything feels all a little bit unsettling. Is it like that?
I think it's a combination of the two. For the most part, Sonny and Butch are happy to stay in space. They probably planned for the possibility that they would be there much longer than the day that they had said that was the first opportunity to return, which wasn't really cut in stone or anything. It was just, this was the first opportunity. There's a lot of emotions that go along, but for the most part, they're probably pinching themselves thinking, great, I've got another day in space. I get to look at Earth. I get to do some experiments or whatever it is they're doing.
I love the idea of being able to, you know, ring up maybe a company that's been pressuring you to pay a bill or do something and ask you why you haven't been, why you weren't there when you said you were going to be there. And you're like, well, I'm really sorry, but I was stuck in space.
Like,
no way.
Right. But now they have all these ways to do things online. So there's not
any
excuses. Now we can even pay our taxes in space.
There's no respite anywhere, yeah. Is there?
No.
Former astronaut Susan Kilrain there. Well, that is what's happening to the astronauts in that capsule. But what about Boeing, which is still dealing with a reputational fallout from some serious and well-publicised problems with its aircraft? Joey Roulette is the Business of Space correspondent for the Reuters news agency. This delay to the return of Starliner, how damaging is this for Boeing?
That's a good question. I mean, this whole program has really set Boeing's reputation back. If we look back in the past few years, they've gone through a number of blunders, a number of hiccups. And this current mission, you know, it's still ongoing. They do have a ton of issues that they have to work through and that they have to fix. I mean, it kind of just deepens that already damaged reputation that Boeing has been kind of grappling with since around 2019 with Starliner.
Susan Kilrain, who we just heard from there, was pretty clear that these things are mapped out when it comes to sort of launch dates, for example, even though they knew that there was this helium leak on board, and said that, you know, despite any pressure to go ahead with the launch, if it wasn't safe, they wouldn't have done so. I mean, hindsight is a wonderful thing. Does it now look like it was a bit of an error to launch and not wait a little bit more?
You know, that's hard to say. I mean, when you ask the mission officials how serious the helium leaks specifically are right now, I mean, you know, NASA will kind of downplay it and they'll say this is not really a big issue. It's somewhat well understood. They've been kind of tweaking the thrusters and they've been testing them and they haven't seen those leak rates grow. In fact, they've actually decreased in some cases. But I mean, you're right. There was a helium leak before the launch. They didn't think it was worth going into the Starliner capsule and fixing it before launch because that maybe would have done a lot more to the system and been more risky. So they proceeded with it. But, you know, like was said earlier, the thruster issues are a little bit more concerning now. And they think they have the helium leak issue under control. But who knows going forward in this mission?
Given how much money it's cost so far and the delays to this whole program, what's in it for Boeing? Why are they pressing ahead with this? Why do they want to take all this on?
Yeah, I think Boeing must be asking itself that same exact question with each day on this program. I mean, when they were awarded this contract in 2014, they thought this was a crucial moment to maintain their expertise in space. Boeing has been in space for decades. They have experience on the ISS, but they have never built a spacecraft like this before. And so now that they are years behind schedule, this costs Boeing about $1.5 billion of its own money. Their contract with NASA has increased by $300 million to about $4.5 billion. And, you know, Crew Dragon has been flying humans for years. That's SpaceX's rival capsule. And so there's really not much of a private market for customers beyond NASA whenever Boeing finishes development of this capsule that Boeing can tap into. And in fact, it still has to figure out which rockets it's going to use to launch Starliner for its last three missions. And so that's a whole other kind of cost that it's going to have to figure out. There's redesigns that NASA is discussing with Boeing, and that's going to cost more money. So at this point, it seems like it's just a lot more expensive to do something that SpaceX has already done years ago and for which there's not much of a market.
And that was Joey Roulette, who's the business of space correspondent for the Reuters news agency. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us in just a couple of minutes. We're going to be heading to Miami to talk to our correspondent there about the situation in Bolivia in the city of La Paz. Do stay tuned. A reminder of our top story today on NewsHour. President Ruto of Kenya's abandoned planned tax rises in response to deadly protests on Tuesday. One of the many young people taking part in those demos, 26-year-old Chris, gave us his reaction.
For me, I think it's a sigh of relief. It feels good to finally win one, at least for us as the youth. I mean, seeing him back down and actually concede to our very specific demands, yeah, it's a sigh of relief, I think. More than ever, I think our leaders now know that what we the people think matters.
Other headlines this hour. Bolivia's president has denounced an unauthorized gathering of troops and tanks outside government buildings in the capital, city of La Paz. More on that in just a moment. And the US Supreme Court has accidentally published a major opinion on abortion rights, which appears set to overturn a near total ban on the practice in the city of Idaho. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, as we've been reporting, there appears to be a military coup underway in Bolivia, with reports that troops and armour vehicles have encircled government buildings in the city of La Paz. Let's talk to Luis Fajardo, who's head of BBC Monitoring's Latin American Bureau. Luis is based in Miami. Luis, what more can you tell us about what's going on?
Bolivian media are reporting that the Vice President, David Choquehuanca, has confirmed in a social media posting that Bolivia is experiencing what he calls a military coup. This after the violent appearance of military troops near the Palacio Quemado, the site of government in Bolivia. General Juan José Zúñiga, as the head of the army, is apparently commanding what seems to be a military insurrection against the government of leftist President Luis Arce. General Zúñiga had been having a series of public confrontations with the person who was seen as the political mentor of President Arce, who was the former President Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of Bolivia. And apparently he has decided to take action. There's an enormous amount of confusion, as you could imagine. And right now people are trying to establish what is happening. There are video images, apparently, of troops surrounding the Palacio Quemado in downtown La Paz and actually trying to enter the presidential palace right now.
And there's been already, I think, condemnation from leaders around the region. Is that right?
Certainly. Marcelo Ebrard, the foreign minister of Mexico, has been among the many people saying that democracy must be respected in the region. Certainly is going to create an enormous amount of rejection if this actually continues across Latin America. And the Bolivian government is asking for solidarity in this situation they are facing right now.
Give us a bit more of the context. What seems to be the reason for the dispute between the general that you spoke of, Juan José Zúñiga, and the government and also the former president? What's it about?
It's very, very ambiguous right now. I would be hesitating to say what is the definitive thing that sparked this. However, like I said, there had been a series of public confrontations between the government and the military. They have always had a tricky situation. Of course, this being a left-wing government, it created a lot of resistance in many sectors of the military. Former President Evo Morales was... had a very traumatic exit from power a few years ago. And there had been clearly a continuous antagonism between this. But at this moment, it's very hard to establish what exactly is happening and what would General Zúñiga exactly want from this situation.
And just one final brief thought. I mean, is the government at the moment, is it popular in Bolivia? Does it command popular support?
Well, President Arce represents a sector of Bolivia that for many, many years was seen as excluded from political life of the country, the backing of the indigenous rights movement. So in that sense, they can argue that they represent a sector of Bolivia that still backs a government that claims to represent their interests. However, the president of Bolivia has had a very rocky mandate up to now, and it is surrounded by a lot of ambiguity at this point to see what kind of support he would actually manage to keep after this situation.
Indeed, Luis. Thank you very much indeed. Very fast-moving situation. Luis Fajardo of BBC Monitoring based in Miami. Let's head to France before we go now, because these are worrying times there. The approaching snap election, which President Macron unexpectedly called after his trouncing by the far right in the European elections, looks set to usher in a period of deep instability. All the polls suggest there'll be another hung parliament, or there'll be an outright victory for the National Rally on the far right, and France will have something that was unthinkable until very recently. So how dangerous is the situation? Could it lead, as Mr. Macron has warned, to violence? Hugh Schofield reports.
What could be finer than music on a hot summer's day in a historic town square in provincial France? This is Fontainebleau, home once to the Emperor Napoleon. Today, it's natural Macron territory. Like the man, it's prosperous, international, and since 2 weeks ago, deeply worried.
I am Juliette Villegrain.
I've come to see the woman who, till the assembly was so unexpectedly dissolved, was the local MP. Today she's campaigning again for the Macronite centre, and with a simple message: keep out the extremes.
The extremes are very dangerous. The right wing, the RN, once they are in the power, they are there to stay. They will change things so that we won't be able to get them out. And of course, right now they tell you what you want to hear. In reality, those propositions are not possible.
So What are the risks? I believe that...
For all their efforts, though, the Macronite centre in France is not holding. Things are falling apart. The far right could win in 2 weeks, or there'll be political paralysis. And for the veteran commentator Nicolas Bavaret, either possibility presents risks. A debt crisis, social unrest, political collapse.
It's really a situation where you may have a brutal breakup of the institutions.
Si on va au bout de votre raisonnement, le pays explose ou c'est la guerre civile.
And there was another word on President Macron's lips this week. Guerre civile, civil war.
Civil war is a word that Macron mentioned.
Yes, and I think that it's very dangerous because the fact for him to use this word and to try to save his power, in fact, on fear, this is very dangerous because you know that in a democracy, when you play on fears, then you have hate and then violence. So this dynamic is one of the most dangerous for a democratic country.
So what you're saying is that when President Macron talks about civil war, even as a theoretical possibility, he makes it more possible?
Yes, of course.
Alarmist? It certainly feels it out here in the southern part of the Fontainebleau constituency, where the peace of the deep French countryside seems to mock the scary talk of the towns. But this is prime national rally turf.
I am not hurt when I see a Muslim who prays...
The RN candidate is Ivanka Dimitrova, Bulgarian by birth, so an immigrant herself, but a woman who feels a profound cultural attachment to France and a fear that its distinctiveness is under threat from uncontrolled immigration. People who come here, she says, cannot expect to rule the roost.
But the dominating one must stay dominating.
Are you a dangerous party?
No, I don't think so. No, no, no. Certainly not.
Are you an extremist party?
No, I don't see anything extreme. When you have your family and someone is doing harm to the members of your family, you want to protect them. Are you extremist with this? No. Our family is France. We want to protect our family. That's all.
Hugh Schofield reporting. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.